You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Tis a season for lots of cooking and eating, whether it's homemade ravioli, latkes and applesauce, or chopped chicken liver. We're celebrating holiday traditions and the unforgettable meals that bring families together. All month long, our listeners have been sending us their recipes for the special dishes that represent their culture and heritage. And New York Times food columnist and cookbook author Melissa Clark selected a few standouts, and she's here today to talk about the recipes and speak with the cooks who submitted the ones that she chose. We'll also take calls from you about the recipes that make your holiday special. So if you would like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. I think that covers it all.
That should do it, yeah.
Although today you have a really interesting piece on holiday bread.
Yes, a challah.
No, challah is a bread that is eaten pretty much every week as part of the Sabbath tradition.
Yes.
But you have a little twist on it. Do you think challah is too bland? Is that why you've
sorry,
taken
I tried
a
to
neutral
mess it up.
Oil out of it and put in olive oil and also orange juice?
Well, okay, so the original recipe comes from my friend Robin's mother, Myrna Aronson, in Rhode Island. And the orange juice, her original recipe had canola oil and then orange juice. And the orange juice isn't very orangey. It just adds like this sort of like brightness. Like, what is that? What makes this challah so good? I don't know what makes this challah
Rather
so good.
Rather than lemon, which is what you usually add for a little brightness?
Because it also adds sweetness. Mm. And, you know, you usually do add a little bit of sugar to challah. And so if you're adding orange juice, you actually add less sugar, just a touch. And then the orange juice makes it a bit sweet. And it really just adds this bright, yummy sort of nuance without it tasting orangey. So what I did to this original recipe was I increased the orange flavor by adding just a little bit of zest because I wanted a more pronounced flavor. And then instead of canola oil, I wanted to try olive oil because I've been going crazy using olive oil in baked goods. I think it's so rich and so delicious, and it's a very healthy oil. It's very good for you. So I thought, well, let's try it. And, you know, if you think about it, I mean, it's not a huge flavor. It's not a huge presence. It's, again, with the orange, it's just a little something, a little complexity that makes it seem like this is even richer than it is. And challah is already very rich. So I find it delicious. And I'd love, you know, if anybody out there has any thoughts on this, I would love to know what you think about
it. And have you tried it for French toast?
Yes, it's so good. So I've tested the recipe a lot. And we had all these extra, you know, I'd make it two or three times and I'd have all these extra loaves. So, of course, what do you want to do with them? You want to make French toast because challah, I think, is the perfect bread for French toast. I mean, brioche is good too, but challah, now that's really good.
Christmas and Hanukkah overlap this year for the first time since 1978. Are there certain recipes that work for both holidays?
I think so. I mean, so this year we're doing, you know, we celebrate Christmas Eve and we celebrate Hanukkah, and they happen to be on the same day, which is both good and bad. It means we can't do it twice, but it means we can have a big blowout. So we're doing latkes and we're doing roast goose. And those are two dishes that are, you know, roast goose is very Christmassy, latkes are obviously for Hanukkah, but they go perfectly well together. And you really are creating something that is a traditional dish in Eastern Europe and Northern Europe as well, but it also celebrates both traditions.
We got several brisket recipe submissions. Brisket and latkes,
yes.
are a classic Hanukkah combination. And one of the recipes you chose was potato latkes stacks with Canadian bacon and apples. Sent to us by Amanda on the Upper East Side. She wrote to us, when Christmas, Hanukkah, and my birthday collide, I must have all my favorite things together. Amanda, welcome to our show.
Hi.
Don't you make a chunky applesauce to pair with your latkes?
Of course.
So you describe yourself as a, what is the chunky applesauce? Is it just your standard chunky applesauce?
The applesauce is the easiest part. You can do it in advance. You just throw some apples in a pan, put a little bit of water on the bottom so it doesn't scorch, throw in a couple of cinnamon sticks, and cook the crap out of it until, you know, it's the consistency that you like.
You describe yourself as a latke traditionalist, but isn't there Canadian bacon in this?
Well, you know, it's Hanukkah, or whatever you want to call it. So, you know, why not? I'm thinking that instead of, you know, I'll just put it out on a platter. The Canadian bacon is really a misnomer. Canadian bacon is not like American bacon. It's really like little mini rounds of ham steak.
Mm-hmm.
So you can, like, just put it out on a platter along with the applesauce and the latkes and the sour cream and let people have at it if they want it. If they don't want it, you know.
Melissa,
yeah, everybody make your own.
Is Canadian bacon from the same part of the pig?
No, it's actually, it is. It's so it's a ham, so it'd be from the fleshy.
The loin.
Why do they call it bacon?
Right.
I guess because you're supposed to fry it, or maybe you'd have it like bacon. Oh, no, because it's cured, of course, because it's cured like bacon. That's why, right?
Yeah,
isn't that right?
I think
it's cured.
Usually when you get it, it's already pre-cooked.
Yeah.
But you could brown it in advance and put it away in a little bit of foil. While you make your latkes, which should always be served fresh out of the pan.
Absolutely.
As far as I'm concerned.
I agree 100%.
And Melissa, what are some non-traditional latke recipes? Should sweet potatoes, leeks,
I think we have to just linger on the bacon fact. Because don't you think like that? To me, that was, when I saw that, I was like, I saw
all right,
that
recipe. Well, let's stop calling it bacon.
Okay, let's call it ham.
In Canada, they call it back bacon.
Okay.
And it's from the loin. It's a completely different part of the pig.
Let's call it ham.
It's not from the pork belly.
Right.
It's actually on sale right now from Fresh Direct. $12.99 a pound, and you can get it sliced extra thick.
It seems so naughty to me to combine latkes and a pork product.
I know.
And it just, so that's why I was intrigued by it. I was like, are you allowed to do that? And of course, you know, if you're not religious, and then you can do whatever you want. But to me, it was sort of that.
As long as you have your health insurance paid up.
And as long as you tell your guests.
Now, do you have favorite potatoes to use for a latke?
Who are you asking? Both of us. What do you think? You go first.
Well, I go for 2/3 russet, which is Idaho potatoes, and 1/3 Yukon Gold.
What do you like about the mix?
Well, there's different levels of starchiness, and I also like to use, like, different graters, so you get, like, a mix of, like, fine grating and thick shreds.
Hmm. Interesting. So I
grate them alternately with the onions, which keeps the potatoes from browning.
And do you have a favorite kind of onion to use?
No, just plain old yellow onion.
Well, there's yellow onions, there's white onions, there's red onions.
Red onions don't work as well in latkes, I don't think. I think they look, you can see them. And, you know, I think they ruin the appearance, I think. And they brown faster because of they start out darker. They have a high sugar content. So I'm actually against red onions for latkes personally, but, you know.
Well, we're going to move on to another caller. Thank you so much, Amanda.
Thank you from Princeton.
Thank
you for bringing that idea of latkes and pork. Like I said, I'm still wrapping my head around it.
Joe from Princeton, New Jersey, sent us what he calls his famous chopped chicken liver recipes. Joe, you say it's a family recipe demanded for all holidays, but don't some people try to avoid chopped liver?
Well, they do, but they don't have good taste. Some people hate it. Well, it's very unhealthy, right? It's got liver, eggs, salt, and chicken fat. The only healthy thing maybe is the onions.
Is chicken fat unhealthy, Melissa?
I mean, I would say all of those things are perfectly healthy, but that's my own personal nutrition slant, is that they're whole. No, but that they're whole foods. They're real foods. They're not from a can. They're not from a jar. Chicken livers are actually full of minerals and vitamins. They're very, very good for you. They are, and eggs have been vilified in the past. They've proven themselves to be also a very healthful food. I mean, the schmaltz, you know, you should limit your fat, but you don't eat a ton of it, and it's just a delightful dish.
And Joe, you say your mother-in-law taught you to use more eggs and more chicken fat.
Right. No, it started with my mother, who was from the era when you overcooked everything, and the chicken livers were overcooked and dry, and the eggs were cooked 20 minutes or more. They were dry. And so my mother-in-law told me, first of all, you use 6 eggs for a pound of livers, which is much more than any other recipe calls for. that you cook the livers covered, and then you kick.
Just that keeps the moisture in?
Keeps the moisture in. And livers, if you overcook them, get bitter. So it keeps the moisture in, and you can monitor them so that they don't get too brown.
But you also recommend using a sharp knife to chop the liver and not a meat grinder or a food processor. Oh. Does that really affect the texture of the liver that much?
Absolutely. You have much more control over. You can chop it as much as you like. You can make it as fine as a pate or a mousse, but I like it chunky. And that way, if you put it in a Cuisinart or a meat grinder, you'll have less control. I'm a control freak, and I control the car, control the chopped liver, control it all. And you can also keep tasting as you mix the stuff in.
Now, Melissa, you tried the recipe. I'm sure you've made chopped liver many times before. What's the difference between this and other chopped livers?
I was going to make the recipe. Confession, I haven't made the recipe yet. I plan
Poor
to make
you.
The I know, but I'm going to. I plan. It's actually going to be on my Hanukkah menu for Saturday night. I'm going to make it on Friday. I can make it a day ahead, right?
Yeah, I say make sure you take it out of the refrigerator and let it come to room. There's a big difference in the taste in
yes.
terms of the temperature, and you have to watch your chicken fat and your salt to at the last minute, get it just right.
But be warned, Melissa,
yes.
he wrote on his recipe, you will fail at least twice.
That's okay. You know what? I'm really good at turning failures into successes. So even if I mess up your recipe, I think I'll probably, as long as you use good ingredients, it's going to come out well, even if it's not exactly the Joe version. What I was interested in about your recipe was that you say specifically not to brown the onions. Now, I was always taught when you're making chopped liver, you should get the onions brown. So this is a very different thing. I was just curious about that.
What do you say, Joe?
Soft and translucent.
Okay.
I think they're sweeter that way. And you'll note, we haven't talked about it, but it's in the recipe. I also add raw onion.
Right.
So that cuts the sweetness a little, gives it, you know, because the Galician people, the Galicianers, put sugar in everything. So maybe that's where the sweet onion comes from. But you need the piquant taste. And that's also something you keep testing as you chop. Add a little more, because once you've made the whole mixture and you put it in the refrigerator, you can't add any more of the raw onion.
Right.
Now, how different is this from a pâté, a French pâté?
Well, the texture is, you know, a French pâté is so much smooth, or at least a chicken liver. You know, in France, you would never get a chunky chicken liver pâté. You'd get a smooth liver pâté, or you'd get a chunky pork pâté. So this is a chunky chicken liver pâté or a chunky chicken liver spread. It's very different.
We're going to take a little break and come back with more listeners. Min Choi is next. She has a recipe for galbi jin, or Korean braised beef short ribs.
Mm.
And she's on the line. We'll be back with her in just a moment. With me in the studio is Melissa Clark, whose articles on food appear every Wednesday in the New York Times. She has a wonderful recipe today for challah. And we're doing a listener holiday recipe call-in. We're back with Melissa Clark, who writes a Good Eats column in the Wednesday New York Times. She looked through a whole bunch of listener submissions of recipes for the holiday and chose some that she thought were really fabulous. And we've been speaking to the people who sent them in. And now we're going to go to Min Choi from Brooklyn, who sent us her recipe for galbi jim, Korean braised beef short ribs. She says that everybody has different variations of the same dish, but this one is her mom's recipe. Short ribs are really popular in Korea, Min?
Short ribs are very popular in Korea. We grill them and we steam them and we make a stew. This is more like a stew format, but it's more close to more like a French bourguignon, kind of, a little bit like a less sauce or soup base in a stock.
Now, do you use a certain cut of meat, or can you prepare the dish using English-style short ribs, which are cut along the bone?
Yeah, that's fine. And which, you know, we normally cut in a kind of a little bit of a dice size of with the bones in it. But since I've been in here, and, you know, that's a short rib that we can easily get in any supermarket, and that I use them.
You say that you don't use sugar in your recipe because sugarcane wasn't available in Korea, but you use Korean rice syrup instead as a sweetener. How much does that affect the flavor?
It affects the flavor a little bit more subtle because these days, you know, every household, they have a sugar around and then they use the sugar. That's the main reason why that on a recipe that marinated with grated Asian pear, which these days we still do, because that's some sweetness you can get. And then with onion, and back in those years, there is a Korean rice syrup. It tastes pretty similar as a corn syrup. And, you know, the peninsula did not have a sugar cane. So anything related with sweetness is getting everything from rice.
Now, how do you get Korean rice syrup? Are there shops that carry it? And is it different than Japanese rice syrup?
Or brown rice syrup. You see brown rice syrup in health food stores a lot.
Right, yeah.
Where do you are there special stores that I have to go to for Korean rice syrup?
In Korean market. Obviously, in Korean market with all different kinds of versions available. But if you don't have Korean rice syrup, then I substitute with the maple syrup.
Oh, perfect. That's easy.
Now, you say you made it for Thanksgiving one year and it was more popular than the turkey. Melissa, wouldn't most things be more popular than turkey if we weren't stuck with it as part of the Thanksgiving tradition?
I think that's probably true. And the stew sounds so good. I mean, it sounds very spicy and rich. I want to know, so on Christmas, you serve this on Christmas?
Christmas or Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Typically, this dish is served in Korean Thanksgiving Day,
which is when
the Chinese Moon Day is a Korean Thanksgiving Day. It's celebrated on August 15th.
Okay.
So these dishes are popular. Typically, my mother always cooks that. And you know, back in those years, not every family can afford to have meat or beef, or especially short ribs, very expensive because of the use of cost. And Koreans are very popular with the Korean barbecue. That's also rib. And then this is also short rib. So, you know, these dishes are not affordable to have a family hoard to cook it every other day.
Right.
So, right, these are the special for even the Chinese New Year's Day, which is a Korean New Year's Day as well. And twice a year, that when I was growing up, and then, you know, when I was a kid, and those are dishes are like we kind of looking forward to it. Since I'm in a state, and you know, good close friends are my family, and also working in the restaurant industry for such a long time, and not every restaurant coworker can have a celebrate any every holidays. So
it's a real celebratory dish.
Ben, thank you so much for participating. That recipe sounds fascinating.
And these are all going to be available on your...
Well, we have a number of them available, a couple that are coming up. In fact, the one that's coming up now, Jennifer from Chester, New Jersey, sent us her grandmother's recipe for tortilla, a French-Canadian meat pie. Hi, Jennifer. Now, you mix beef and pork. Is that better than just using one kind of meat?
I think it does lend to the flavor much better. I use a ground sirloin, which I think tastes really good but doesn't have a lot of fat, and then the ground pork adds the fat for additional flavor. And in some recipes, they actually even add veal. I just don't do that.
Now, one of the big problems in doing meat pies is that the crust can get soggy. How do you avoid that?
When you cook it in a large pie, sometimes the bottom does tend to get soggy, but we actually make them in the form of empanadas now. So they're just little handheld meat pies, and they stay quite crispy. I cook them on top of parchment paper. And the meat is mixed with mashed potato, and it's not a real soggy filling, so it doesn't really affect the crust too much.
And you serve it with ketchup?
I do. I eat it with tons of ketchup. I'll admit it.
But you could probably serve it. I mean, it sounds like a great hors d'oeuvre. Is that how you serve it, or is it more of a main course?
We eat it as a main course on Christmas Eve. It's what we look forward to. But you could serve it as an hors d'oeuvre, especially my mother actually tends to make little teeny tiny mini pies, like in a mini cupcake pan.
Uh-huh. Yep.
As an hors d'oeuvre.
Now, Melissa, it's interesting. Jennifer says on her recipe that the pie is made throughout Canada and in New Orleans. Because it's Cajun?
I'm not sure, actually. Do you know the history of it? I know, actually, that I know Sam Sifton and the Times just did a big article about it as well. So I know there's a lot of information out there. Do you know much about the origin?
What I know is that it's a French origin, and so, you know, there's a very large history between Quebec, Canada, and the Acadians in New Orleans.
Yeah,
you know,
so
there's
the Cajun,
quite a history. So, and it's, you know, it's traditionally also served at the Réveillon, which is the big meal that takes place after you come home from midnight mass on Christmas Eve, which also takes place in New Orleans. So I think it's just, you know, that cultural connection. But it is served in other provinces of Canada that aren't French. And there's, you know, little twists on it, bacon or chopped meat versus ground meat.
So do you fry them or do you bake them?
I bake them.
Mm-hmm.
I bake them. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for participating. And as I said, the recipe is available on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. And so is the next one. And the others will be up later today. So all of the recipes will be made available. Our next person, next contributor is Karen from Flanders, New Jersey. A lot of our listeners who wrote in are from New Jersey. Do you think that
New Jerseyans are very festive, and they guess this, and they're itching to share their recipes, which is terrific.
It may be why the governor has a weight problem. Karen, you sent us a recipe from an Italian American Christmas Eve tradition, baccalà salad.
That's right.
Could you tell us about it? It uses seven different kinds of fish.
Well, no, it's actually baccalà is salted dried codfish.
Uh-huh.
And you get it in these big planks, and they're like boards, and you have to soak the fish for at least 3 days and empty the water to get all the salt off of it. And then you have to cook it over the stove until it gets flaky. The first time I made it, I didn't realize I had to cook it, and I called my mother-in-law up and asked why it was so tough, and she asked me how long I cooked it, and I said, oh, I didn't know you were supposed to cook it. So we did the whole thing, and then from then on, you know, I now know I have to cook it. But, you have to get the salt off of it, and then you cook it until it flakes, and you let it cool, and then you add the olive oil and garlic and lemon and parsley and celery to it.
It sounds so fresh and just...
It is so fresh, and every time I make it, I think to myself, why don't I make this in the summer? Because it's very light and fresh and lemony, and there's no mayonnaise in it, and it keeps very well. And I never do make it in the summer, but I always think about it.
Maybe this will be the year. So do you have your is your baccalà already soaking? Do you have it all in
It's soaking in the laundry room. Yeah.
That's where we usually soak our baccalà.
No.
I don't know. I don't have a laundry room like that. But if I did, I would definitely soak my baccalà in there.
It can get kind of smelly. So
that's smart.
I got the original recipe from my mother-in-law, who made it with vinegar peppers, and she hated fish. And I think she made the baccalà for my father-in-law, who loved fish. And when she moved to California, she didn't make it for us anymore, obviously. So I found a restaurant that made it, and they used lemon instead of the vinegar peppers. And then when I had to make it myself, I chose the lemon because it is really nice and fresh.
And those vinegar peppers can be rather intense.
They sure can be. I think that's the only reason my husband would eat the baccalà was for the vinegar peppers. But, it's funny, not too many people in this family like baccalà, but I came into this Italian family, and I enjoy it. It's really good.
Well, it must be good
because your kids, you say, like
my
it.
My kids love it. Yeah, the first one I made it and called my mother-in-law up in California, and she asked me how much I was making, and I told her 5 pounds. She was horrified because she couldn't figure out who would eat all that bacala, and I said they want leftovers to take home. So, yeah, we make a lot of it.
Thank you for participating. We're going to speak now to Sherry from Washington Heights, who said that her mother's ravioli recipe is a Christmas ritual. You say that your mother never followed a recipe, just made it from muscle memory. But can't ravioli be rather intimidating to make?
Well, she made it look really easy. She would just take this, she would make this little volcano of flour and crack a couple of eggs into the crater and add a little bit of water and salt and just knead it out and very carefully roll it out. And then when it got thin enough, she would take it and she would put it into a pasta press. And I think the secret to her delicious ravioli was the very thin dough.
Is it all that different from making other kinds of pasta?
I don't think so. It's just the extra step of the filling. And then she would take the filling. She would make spinach with cheese, Parmesan cheese and breadcrumbs and maybe a little salt and pepper and just roll that out into kind of like a little stick and take the little dots and then roll it and dot little pieces onto the very thin dough and then just fold it over. And our job as children, we would just squeeze the little ravioli into little squares and then cut them out with a little zigzag cutter.
Now, there are ravioli makers, Melissa. have you seen those? Where you put the dough onto them and then you just get the depression, you put the meat on and then cover it.
It doesn't seem like it's that much easier, frankly, right? I mean, because if you're going to lay the dough out or lay it on top of a mold, you still need to, you need to fill each one. You need to press each one. I mean, I guess it will help you press it more secure. But if you have a bunch of children who are there ready to help you, I feel like that is such a good use of their time.
And what are you putting in the ravioli? Are you doing meat or sausage, or are you doing vegetables and cheeses? There's so many different kinds of things you can make a ravioli out of.
She was very traditional. She used either ground beef and cheese with breadcrumbs or spinach and cheese with breadcrumbs. And as she got, once when she got older and she was no longer able to make ravioli, one time we made squash ravioli and she just thought that was just an abomination, but she actually liked it when she did.
Mostly it's made with marinara, but you say you can also use chicken broth or a butter sauce.
Right. I think my father, he had ulcers, so he, later on in life, he had trouble having marinara sauce, so she would always make it in chicken broth for him. And I think, and that was actually a very delicious way to have it, too, sort of a ravioli soup. It was very simple, but very, very tasty.
Thank you so much for sharing it with us. And as I said, all of these recipes will be posted on our show page at WNYC.org/Lopate. Melissa, obviously you're not going to make all of these things during the holiday. Although during Hanukkah, you can make a whole bunch of different things every day.
I'm definitely going to make the chopped liver because it's different from my technique, so I'm very curious. And the beef galbi sounds delicious. All of these recipes sound delicious. That's why I thought that it'd be great to share with all of the listeners.
And I would have thought by now, because you've been writing about food and meeting chefs so often, that you'd know everything, but there's always something new.
Isn't there always something to learn? That's the best part of both of our jobs, I think, is that we are always learning.
You should check out Melissa Clark's recipe in today's Times. It's for challah, made a little untraditionally, but sounds just delicious. And I'm going to be taking some time off at the beginning of January. Melissa, you'll be filling in for
me. I'm going to fill in, January 9th. So I look forward to all of you calling in. So remember that date.